Accession number 27347, Reel 18.
Stanley Brand, Reel 18.
We had a lot of practice on dummy deck landings because this was to be our destiny, and we had to be good at it. And of course it's an expensive thing to have a full-blown carrier earmarked purely for training people, and we were so short of carriers it couldn't be spared for that. Argus was the training carrier, but it was also used in the Med for helping keep Malta supplied. We were desperately in need of carriers at the time. We only had about five all told. So
how did you practice those dummy deck landings?
It was a case of a bloke standing at the end of the runway with two ping pong bats or something looking like ping pong bats, and we would come in to land under his instruction. We had to do a curved approach because with the big radial engine in front of us you couldn't see straight ahead, with the attitude needed for catching an arrestor wire, your tail had to be well down, which meant virtually having your nose in the air, your tail down, creating a lot of drag because of the angle of attack of the wings to the line of flight, with quite a lot of engine revs on. Hanging on the prop is what we called it, and that's the best description of all. So you came in on a curve, hanging on your prop, following the batsman's instructions to go higher, come lower. To go higher, you put on more engine revs. To go lower, you took off engine revs. He would straighten us up by getting us to put more bank on in the turn or less bank on in the turn, he would guide us in and then give us the cut when we were an appropriate height above the beginning of the runway, generally about 4 feet he'd give us the cut, we would then roll. But before coming to a halt, we'd open up and go around again because we had a runway ahead of us, an empty runway. And we'd climb up and do another circuit and another dummy landing. He'd have us, possibly four or five of us on at any given time, spaced out round the circuit so that we were coming in, getting the practice of obeying the batsman, then the practice of opening up and going round again. It was good routine. It was good practice.
Would the runway be marked out for the area that you would be deck landing on?
No. It had to be any runway, because it depended which way the wind was on that day, and most of the airfields that we used were in use for other purposes. As I said, we had Russians collecting Marylands and Albemarles and other obsolete aircraft that we were giving them, so that we had a variety of people and aircraft on the circuit, coming in, interrupting what we were doing, or we were interrupting their accessibility. I don't think that our batsmen ever tried to bring a Russian in. No, I don't think they would have appreciated that.
And how did the batsman indicate? You mentioned the things that he could ask you to do with the bats. How does he indicate height or get lower or how to bank? What does he do with how does he motion the bats?
Well, holding the bats at arm's length, holding them horizontal meant come on as you are. pushing both arms down meant do it quickly, come down quickly. Putting the arms down in an inverted V and holding them there meant come down, you are too high, come down, but gently. To get you to put a lot of power on, he would put his arms up in a V and do it quickly and wave them up and down like that, as much as to say, come on, come on, come on, come on, and denote the urgency by the frequency of his motion. But to say you are a shade too low, gain a little bit of height, he'd put his arms up in a V gently and hold them there until we'd gained sufficient height. It was a very expressive thing. He could express urgency, he could express contentment by the agitation he showed, or the calm, cool, collected approach that he showed.
How did he give you the cut?
The cut was, he brought the two bats across his body in a cross, down, and that was the cut.
And an explanation of what does the cut mean?
Oh, take your power off immediately. It was a case of an immediate cutting of the engine. Not stopping the engine, but making it ineffective.
How easy was it to see his motions when you were flying around in the circuit and banking into the last approach?
If you did it correctly, there was no problem except the usual problem of eyes watering in a cold draft with goggles that had oil smeared on them, and maybe the odd flies and grit and dust and eyes that were watering and felt as if they'd had sand blown into them, which they probably had, and of course problems from the night before. If you'd had a few beers, your eyes were not always at their best.
What other things were you practicing while you were there?
Our first experience of heavy load carrying. We'd never carried a torpedo, so they gave us a dummy concrete torpedo weighing 1,600 pounds to get us used to the reduced lift, the reduced buoyancy in takeoff, the more rapid sinking when you took some power off on the approach, getting used to a heavy load. That was one of the things. We did a lot of bombing practice in the Firth of Tay on the sandbanks there.
How would that be organised?
There was a bombing range with huts at right angles to the target, with wrens in the huts, with a quadrant sight, and they would get a sight whenever you dropped a smoke bomb, and with the two intersections, they'd mark that on a plot and show you just by how much you'd missed the target.
How would you do your approaches to the target?
Well, it all depended. We did every type of approach. We did the approach that you need for depth charges, which is a long, low, steady approach. the approach that you'd need for a torpedo, which is from a greater range and from much the same height, but you needed a very, very steady aircraft to drop both depth charges and a torpedo. For bombing, we did a lot of semi-dive bombing. We did a lot of rocket practice, which was a fairly steep dive from about 1,000 feet. And it was just a case of getting your aircraft in the right position to fire the appropriate weapon that you were dealing with.
Did you have any form of sights for the bombing, or was it judgment?
No, we did the bombing by intuition, which meant lots of practice, because you hadn't anything to guide you except your own knowledge of correction of mistakes. For instance, if you were actually trying to bomb a target with a form of dive bombing, if you started your pull out of the dive before you released the bomb, you would tend to throw the bomb. You'd be coming down and you're pulling out and release the bomb then, and you'd flick it. It'd probably go over your target. You had to release it while you were still in the dive, count two, and then start pulling out.
You mentioned using smoke bombs. Did you use dummy rockets at all?
We used rockets with solid warheads, which just penetrated. And that was the favoured warhead for submarines, because any other form of warhead, hitting a cylinder, which is the hull of a submarine, if unless you were directly at right angles to the cylinder, you tend to glance off. So having a sharpened nose, an armour-piercing projectile, you're more likely to get it into the hull. And once into the hull, it would go round and round and round inside and do an awful lot of damage. I think only on two occasions did I use explosive rocket warheads. And they were 60-pound warheads, which did do a lot of damage. I also had practice with a flare, because one of the ways that we developed for attacking a submarine, if you got a submarine registering on the radar, air-to-surface vessel radar, you could go into a dive about half a mile before the submarine, go into a dive, pull up, fire the rockets over and above the submarine, and the rocket would the flare would go off when it was on the other side of the submarine and create a moon path with, you hoped, the conning tower of a submarine there, and you were then in a position to go into another dive and fire the armour-piercing rockets. That was a technique that we developed, but I was never able to put that into practice because we always had radar silence where we were, because Jerry had developed a means of detecting your radar signals, so he knew that there was an airborne danger to him, and he'd submerge. So it was a wonderful technique, but never got a chance to use it in practice.
With the rockets, how are they carried on the wings of a swordfish?
We had rocket rails, which consisted of 8 tubes, steel tubes, about 1.25 inch diameter, spaced about 18 inches apart. Spaced about 1.5 inches apart, but each pair was separated from the next pair by about 15 inches, so that a bank of 4 rockets would be supported on 8 rocket rails and spread over a distance of about 4-5 feet. We had one of those under each wing, so that we carried 8 rockets. But we could fire them individually, in pairs, one from each side, or collectively. A battery of 8 rockets fired simultaneously was equivalent to a broadside from an 8-gunned cruiser, a 6-inch diameter gun. In other words, a broadside from a light cruiser, which was quite something from a swordfish.
How would you be able to select in the cockpit how you fired the rocket?
Purely by switches. We also had a distributor, which we called a Mickey Mouse. I don't know if you remember the old alarm clocks with Mickey Mouse on the face of the clock, and the two arms of Mickey Mouse, which went round, which were the arms of the clock. It was the Mickey Mouse alarm clock that made us call this distributor a Mickey Mouse. There was a dial which had the positions of various pieces of equipment on it, and a clockwork wound set of hands that you could set to go around the contacts, so that you could press contacts so that they were not in the path of the Mickey Mouse hand, so that it didn't fire, or you could bring it forward so that it did fire. So you could select on the Mickey Mouse what you were firing and in what order.
And what elements would you use? Well, what method would you use for wanting to fire a rocket in a different way? What choice would you make?
Well, I would have always chosen to fire the whole damned lot in one, on the principle that you might only get one chance, especially with a U-boat submerging. It was your one chance, and you had a better chance of hitting him with the whole lot going. We used to train these so that they converged at a range of about 400 yards. If you went into attack and you had to fire at a greater range than 400 yards, the rockets had crossed each other and had a bigger pattern. It was only a concentrated pattern at the range for which they'd been trained.
Would there be a specific aiming point on a submarine that you would aim for? I mean, would you aim for the conning tower, or would you aim slightly underwater to hit the hull, or something of that order?
I would have aimed for the conning tower, just beneath the conning tower, in the hope of hitting the control room. And the accuracy of rockets was such that you could do this. The only thing is that if the sub had seen you coming and decided to fight it out, he'd be manning all his anti-aircraft fire from the conning tower. Of course, then the thing to do was to try and come from astern so that his forward firing ones couldn't bear on you without shooting the skipper's cap off, because he'd have to be firing across his own conning tower. No, the thing to do was to try and come, in my estimation, slightly at an angle to the submarine, so that you had a long allowance for error. Supposing you were going to drop four bombs or eight rockets, if you fired them all together, you had one chance of hitting him. If you could maneuver into a position where you could go at a slight angle to his course, you wanted to spread them out, and you had a better chance then of getting one right on him, or getting two close to him, or two quite some distance away from him. But try and go the length of the ship, the submarine.
Were you given any instruction in tactics, obviously, while you were training? How you should do these things?
Yes. And we were encouraged to think out ourselves of how we would go about it. Had we anything to add? Because the people who were instructing us had very limited opportunity to face Jerry themselves. We were all learning.
When you fired the rockets, is there a perceivable effect on the aircraft when you fire them?
None at all. The rockets were held onto the rails by a piece of copper wire, which was, I suppose, about 3/32 of an inch diameter, and that had to shear by the power of the rocket propelling the rocket forward, and the piece of copper wire trying to hold it back. It had to shear the copper wire before it could go, and it didn't take, you wouldn't feel the effect if you tried to tow a swordfish by something that was going to shear a piece of copper wire. You'd tow it without noticing that. Sorry, you'd break the tow.
At that time as well, you mentioned obviously training with depth charges and the approaches that you would do, and also the approaches you would do with the torpedo. Did you get an opportunity to drop a live depth charge or fire a live torpedo?
I didn't get a chance to fire a live torpedo. In fact, I never dropped a torpedo. All I did was carry around the circuit a dummy torpedo, and thereby hangs a tail, but I'll come to that.
It's quite amazing, actually, the number of things that you were taught with the string. That sounds incredibly versatile in aircraft, to be able to do all of these different tasks.
That's why they called it the string bag. Like Granny's string bag, it'd always take something else that hadn't been catered for, of a shape and a size that hadn't been catered for, and a weight that hadn't been catered for, and the technique of stowing it that hadn't been done before. That's why we called it the string bag. It was an affectionate family reminder.
At Errol, were you still doing things like cross countries and navigation exercises as well?
Yes, I did a couple of those, but we did all sorts of other things too, like practicing being an escaped prisoner. They took us out in a lorry blacked out, wearing goggles so that we couldn't see, and they'd follow a devious course so that we hadn't an idea where north or south was, and they'd drop us 30 miles from the airfield, and we were to get back. We had tuppence in our pockets to make an emergency phone call from a coin box. But apart from that, we weren't allowed to speak any more English than we knew German. And it was interesting. We were allowed to pinch any service equipment, lorries, motorbikes, cycles, even aeroplanes. We were allowed a complete freedom to do that, but not civilian. We weren't allowed to pinch any civilian equipment. We could pinch turnips from fields, anything eatable, providing that after the escapade we explained where we'd been and what we'd done, and the Navy made recompense to the people. That was great fun. We could jump on goods trains.
Well, can you explain what happened when you did yours?
Well, yes, we were dropped singly. You weren't allowed to be dropped in pairs, but obviously we met up with each other at times. I met up with one chap who was a Glaswegian. We walked an awful long way, and then we saw a bicycle coming, so we stepped back, and it was a policeman on a bike. He saw us, saw that we were in uniform. It was at night. We jumped over a five-barred gate into a sort of wood, and he, bloody fool, propped his bike against the fence and came after us. Well, we did a circle round, came back and pinched his bike. And one on the crossbar, and the other pedalling like mad. And we left him stranded miles away from anywhere. Anyway, we cycled on a heck of a long way. We did get a patch of sky where we saw some stars, and we thought we knew where north was and where south was. We heard the first thing we did was we found a Royal Army Service Corps depot, which was around a village garage, and there was a lorry there which hadn't got any ignition keys in, but my pal from Glasgow knew what to do. He reached behind the dashboard and pulled some wires out and twisted them together and started the lorry. So off we went down the road in the lorry, thinking that we were made, we'd be home in time for supper. And we'd gone about a mile and a half, and the engine seized up. They'd drained the oil out of it, ready for a service change. Anyway, we left it slewed across the road, seized up. We couldn't push it. We couldn't get it out of gear, actually. So we abandoned that and we went on. We heard some train shunting in the distance. We made our way across some fields, getting very wet in the process, falling into ditches and so on, and bogs. got awfully muddy and cold and wet. Anyway, we got to the marshalling yard and we found a train that was beginning to move out, and we jumped into the goods wagon. It was full of porcelain lavatories with a big bed of hay to pack them so that they didn't break. We made a bed out of the hay and slept on top of the lavatory seats.